This is Glenn Fleischman, the editor of Wi-Fi Networking News. Welcome to podcast number 4 in our series, recorded June 27, 2006. In this podcast, I talk to Becca Vargo Daggett of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a group dedicated to help keeping local things local. Daggett, like myself, got sucked into the municipal wireless debate because it came out of nowhere and seemed initially to be dominated by forces that were attempting to prevent municipal ownership or involvement with any telecommunications, cable TV, or broadband services. Now, because the Institute is based in Minneapolis, they had a prime example of this that arose in April 2005, when Minneapolis itself issued an RFP, a request for proposal, to have a network built for them, both fiber optic and wireless. In this interview, Daggett describes how that catalyzed the Institute's involvement and how they've been fighting to get more information and more community involvement in the months since Minneapolis issued its RFP. Meanwhile, St. Paul, the neighboring city of the Twin Cities, is following an entirely different approach towards bringing local involvement in to create a citywide network of some sort using assets they already have and perhaps more municipal ownership. So we'll talk about that in this interview on June 27th, 2006. This is Glenn Fleischman, the editor of Wi-Fi Networking News, and in this podcast, I'll be talking to Becca Vargo Daggett of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, an organization that's inserted itself through a very local angle into the growing debate over municipal scale or metro scale wireless networks, the ownership of them, how they should be built, and what cities are going to get out of them. And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Pleasure to be here.
Well, and I'll have to tell you, I'm like an old liberal and a fiscal conservative. So when I read the site, Institute for Local Self-Reliance excites me because I think I agree with almost everything you do because it's got the local angle, the local ownership, local control part that I think is a great quality of American life. And it has the municipal involvement part where cities or people are taking matters into their own hands. So they're competing against business there. You have some details here on how local towns can compete effectively, or businesses in those towns, against the Walmartization of the world and so forth. So I'll admit my bias up front. I really like the point of view that self-reliance represents.
Well, it's an amazing thing. We actually get asked quite often what our partisan bent is. And the fact of the matter is, it sort of depends on for which party local self-reliance is in vogue at the time. And that sort of depends on who's in control at the federal level. But we really do focus almost exclusively on maximizing communities' local resource base. And that's both in terms of natural resources, but also in terms of what we think are the most important resources, which is human ingenuity. We're a 32-year-old nonprofit, and we really think of ourselves as a think and do tank. We do policy research and analysis for state and local government, but we also provide technical assistance, and we're very hands-on. Over the years, we've worked mainly in issues around energy and distributed generation and bioproducts, you know, from ethanol and biodiesel to you know, plastics made from carbohydrates and things like that. A lot of focus on wind power, but the main issue has always been for us ownership. Mm-hmm. So we like to see ethanol produced by farmer-owned cooperatives. We work with local governments to help them develop policies that promote locally owned businesses and discourage or at least create a level playing field for large big box retailers and chains and so forth. Because what a lot of people don't know is, what people don't realize is that to a large extent, the policy playing field is tilted toward these larger companies. So it's not just about the economies of scale and so forth. It's also about really helping create new rules that promote locally owned businesses and local control. And that's the project that I work with, is the New Rules Project.
And I see how that's a perfect segue into how you obviously got sucked into, as I think I did accidentally as well, municipal wireless, because it wasn't an issue. There really wasn't very much municipal broadband. It was all fiber optic based. There were some successes and some, you know, notable failures, or at least transfers of ownership and complaints about the cost and so forth, but all fiber optic related. Then suddenly out of nowhere comes wireless, and you go through this rapid transition where the incumbents are fighting tooth and nail against the incursion, and over the course of 2 years are now actually generally in support of it, and all their paid for opinions have seemed to change scope too. At what point did the New Rules Project and the Institute get involved in thinking and talking about the ownership of, or the development of, these municipal scale wireless networks?
Well, I can pinpoint the date for you. It was, I think it was April 12th of 2005.
Date very well, actually.
But basically, the city of Minneapolis came out with a request for proposals for a citywide wireless network.
I should point out, you're based in Minneapolis. You are actually based in Minneapolis.
That's right. I'm right here in beautiful Minneapolis, and my hometown issued this RFP. And it was on the front page of the Star Tribune, and I walked into the office, and I walked into my boss's office, and I said, "David, do you recall, did we talk about this as a community? Because we're all pretty attuned people, but we really hadn't heard anything about this. And here was the city presenting as a fait accompli this request for proposals for a privately owned and operated citywide wireless network, with the city as an anchor tenant." And I made some phone calls to the city and ended up talking to folks in the IT department and asking some questions. And I said, "You know, what did you base this decision on?" "Well, you know, we've read some things and we've had some meetings and that's about it." And, well, I asked to see some reports and so forth. And I was asking a lot of questions. About a day and a half later, my boss got a phone call from a gentleman who said, "This person from your office is calling around asking questions, and we don't like it. Can you get her to stop, please?" So at that point, we really had to find out what was going on. And we did. We started doing a lot of research into it. Now, this is not what I was doing at that point. Mm-hmm. I do have a technology background. I was a system administrator before I went back to school and so forth. But I really hadn't been involved in the whole wireless or even broadband area.
Before we get into that too, I want to just mention, so Minneapolis's proposal, as I recall what they wound up issuing, it was mixed use. It was fiber optic. They're asking a contractor to come in at their own expense, but also for their own benefit, to build a mixed fiber optic ring with Wi-Fi as a component of it, with both public and municipal purposes for the network. But the city wouldn't put any money in, and the city would not own the network, but in exchange they'd provide some streamlined access, or access at all, to light poles that they owned, or work with utilities, building tops and such. So that was the idea, was kind of the standard plus because of the fiber component. Come in and build it at your expense, and we'll give you our business as a city, and you can charge some money to let people access the network.
That was exactly it. The city of Minneapolis in around 2001 or 2002 actually outsourced its entire information technology department, or nearly all of it. All of the technical operations were outsourced. And the city has this vision of itself as a purchaser of services. Mm. And so the approach that they took on this wireless RFP is that they want to purchase services. And that was how the RFP was written. It says, you know, here's what we think we can do with citywide wireless. And we want you to build the network, and we'll just buy services from you.
There was something funny about that too, wasn't there? Because they'd actually tried to contract out fiber optic service back in, was it 2000 or 2001? There was a contract with, was it Time Warner? So this was a second attempt to do this in a broader sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Minneapolis's cable franchisee is Time Warner. And Over the years, the city has been trying to get not a citywide, like fiber to the home network, but just a substantial fiber optic institutional network connecting all of the city locations. Like many cities, Minneapolis got some of an institutional network as part of the cable franchise agreement.
Mm-hmm.
They negotiated that with Time Warner and with its predecessor, Paragon. So yeah, back in 2002, the city started floating this idea of a private company building out a fiber institutional network, and the city purchasing services on that network. And to some extent, that was really, issuing the RFP was really about trying to get leverage in the cable franchise negotiations.
Oh.
You'll find, and I'm sure you've noticed, that there's a very strong relationship with between what cities are doing now in terms of trying to ensure that they have high-speed information services and the institutional networks that they've gotten over the last 10 years. And many cities are right now a little nervous because these institutional networks are one of the things that stand to go away, or to for cities to start having to pay much more for them if we move to a national franchise.
Oh,
away
right.
From
this
local
is
franchising.
The telephone companies that want to be able to deliver IP television cable, essentially cable over their DSL lines or cable over their fiber to the node or home, they want a national franchise policy because they don't want to go through what the cable companies have had to do all these years, which is negotiate with thousands of individual boards, which is a give and take, in which the local boards are able to get local resources allocated or to get specific things in exchange for allowing the right of way and the physical plant to be built. So that, I know, is an ongoing effort for where they want it's part of the transition from specific kinds of services like telephone or cable TV to information services, which the incumbents want totally unregulated so they can bypass or at least streamline their access to rights of way and communities that they want to reach.
Right, and many cities have gotten a franchise fee and they've gotten some local access channels and support for public access broadcasting. And many have also gotten some kind of favorable arrangements for an institutional network. For example, in St. Paul, the city pays about $53,000 a year for services that are equivalent of, over $300,000 in the market. So a lot of cities have a pretty good situation.
Then you have the
now,
flip
Minneapolis,
side in Philadelphia. I'm sorry, in Philadelphia, where they're paying potentially millions of dollars a year for services that, when they switch to wireless, might actually cost hundreds of thousands. That's the flip case of that too.
Right, exactly. So cities right now are a little nervous about losing these networks that are favorable under the franchise agreements, and so that is part of their thought process when they're looking at municipal wireless and the fiber backbone for municipal wireless and so forth. Minneapolis never managed to successfully negotiate a good cable franchise institutional network. As a matter of fact, about a month and a half after the city announced the wireless RFP, they also announced that they were suing Time Warner Cable for 20 years worth of cable franchise violations. And included in that lawsuit was the claim that the Time Warner had agreed to build out an institutional network and had never done so.
Fascinating.
And that case was dismissed first by a federal circuit court judge, and most recently they were told to stop even holding hearings on it. And the courts have pretty much said to Minneapolis, you should have taken this up sooner. Too bad.
Interesting. So really, Minneapolis has no leverage over Time Warner. It will potentially have less leverage over them in the future, considering that the case was dismissed. And they are probably running on ancient telecommunications equipment or paying through the nose for what they need to operate city business by having buildings and offices in different locations.
Exactly. So the RFP for wireless called for, as part of the whole project, it calls for the private company that will own the network to build out an expansion of, the city does have some existing city-owned fiber optic that connects, you know, buildings downtown and so forth, and they want that fiber optic that backbone expanded as part of the wireless RFP.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that stands. And the idea, as you said, behind Minneapolis was that that this private company would own the whole thing, and the city will just buy services. And that was how I got drawn into it, because ownership has always been really a priority for us. And at a minimum, we believe in decisions being made by those who are most affected by them. And in this case, that didn't happen. The city treated this as a situation where they were buying services for their own needs, and they didn't feel, it apparently didn't really even occur to them that they should perhaps consult the community about this.
A kind of cart after the horse thing with the number of RFPs where the RFP comes out. This just happened in Sacramento to some extent. It certainly happened in Philadelphia, where the RFP was issued, proposals were accepted, a vendor was selected, and at that point, it seemed like community involvement, participation, and needs were then inserted into the process rather than during the RFP stage, which definitely seemed the wrong. It must have been, I mean, let's be fair, too. The companies involved were bidding on one thing, and then they're asked to negotiate, you know, a whole new set of requirements that may be very valid, but came at that later stage.
Yeah, I think we're seeing some really good examples of community involvement. Mm-hmm. That's certainly been the case in St. Paul, Minneapolis's neighbor, and St. Louis Park, which is just on the western side of Minneapolis.
Mm.
Philadelphia did a very good job of trying to engage the community, and Chicago had quite a few meetings. But this is actually a quote from the head of the San Francisco project. He told the folks at Muni Wireless the other day that he was concerned that they'd gotten a lot of, you know, unsolicited advice from people. But he said, having a strong vision and understand what your guiding principles are, learn from those people, and you could end up going forward in a way that makes sense, not just for you, but for your constituents. And this is a strange quote, because also in San Francisco, I mean, they issued the RFI without any community input, without having had any community meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Once the RFI was out, they did have this, you know, that was an opportunity for input, but by all accounts, the RFP was really written before they even gathered comments through the RFI. So we're seeing some major cities like Minneapolis and San Francisco and Sacramento that are moving forward with this without, it doesn't even seem to occur to them that there should be some level of community involvement in this, that this is something that will affect residents of their cities for a good decade to come.
Well, let's think about this in terms of, like, you know, if a city were developing a new park, which happens all the time, and we know the process that happens. Usually they'll even sometimes hire a firm that specializes in this. They go out to stakeholders. They go to businesses. They go to residents who live nearby. They go to community groups that might use the park for sports or activities. They go to the utilities to figure out what could be available. Could they build a pond there? Is there something they could repurpose? They, you know, put out bids to figure out what it's actually going to cost. They have meeting. I mean, I know in Seattle, if it's anything, I believe Minneapolis, Seattle have a lot in common in terms of engagement and public process. They want, you know, if someone wants to put a new fire hydrant on the corner, it could be months of meetings in order to figure out how that affects things. So, you know, that's for a public resource, a shared thing, something that everyone in a city or even visitors could use, a park. So the process you're describing that these cities are going through, this process seems far below the threshold that would be required to build, you know, a one-block city park.
Yes. And just to be clear, in Minneapolis, we very much have the structure for a community engagement process. Minneapolis has a program, project that dates back to the mid-1980s called the Neighborhood Revitalization Program. And we have 71 neighborhood groups in Minneapolis, each with its own board of directors and monthly neighborhood meetings and different committees. So it's not like they lacked a place to go to talk about this. They had pre-existing meetings set up that they could have approached. And those were the community meetings that we actually ended up going to, because after I started learning more about this and learning that the community hadn't been involved, we decided that the way to get the Minneapolis City Council to maybe think twice about this, because a lot of this was really driven by the executive branch. So we have 13 council members here, and we decided that the way to get them to actually take the time, one, to engage the public on this before they made an irreversible decision and entered contract negotiations, and two, to actually ask that city staff and the people that were providing them with the information do some kind of thorough cost-benefit analysis comparing public ownership and private ownership, which is something that they'd never done, something that San Francisco never did, something that many cities never did. Many cities at this point are taking the attitude, we don't have the money, we can't afford it, therefore we aren't even going to look at what it would look like if we owned it.
Well, and look back, if we go back before, so April 2005 was your insertion point with the local angle. If we go back, say, to February 2005, when the New Media New Millennium Research Council releases their sock puppet report about, you know, how municipal networks are terrible because they're wasteful and they all fail, go back to late 2004, it seemed to me that there was this sort of shell shock thing that happened, is that initially when cities were talking about spending even a penny of their money, and often with a, you know, you look at Philadelphia, which is a multi-million dollar telecom budget, which they were going to be able to conserve. And so there'd be some huge expense in building the network, but there'd be a lot of cost conservation and efficiency in their operation of it. There seemed to be this shell shock thing that happens. So when Minneapolis comes along and issues this RFP, is at a point when it seemed just tacitly cities backed off from even attempting to sell it because the backlash, the state legislators that were attempting in many states through the influence of incumbent telcos and cable companies to pass anti-municipal broadband and anti-municipal telecom laws, seemed like you hit April 2005 in Minneapolis. I don't know if this is part of their thinking or if you ever discovered if it was, but taxpayer dollars seemed to be off the table in most cities by that point. It wasn't even discussed.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it wasn't even discussed here. But there was an ideological bent, both on the part of as I said, the information technology department had already been essentially outsourced. So there was the attitude that the city is simply a purchaser of services, and there is also there was a belief at the city level that the private sector does all of these things better and it should just be left to the private sector. And we don't dispute that, but of course there's a difference between asking the private sector to, I mean, this whole issue, this whole idea of public-private partnerships is a canard, because unless the city is planning on getting into the business of building its own nodes, it's always going to be a public-private partnership. And the question there is the balance between those two. And there's no question that the private sector does innovation better, but the public sector does investments in infrastructure better, because there's less of a demand to get a high return on investment over a short period of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the city needs to cover its costs. It needs to increase efficiency in the city, and it needs to be something that benefits the community, but the city doesn't have to get a 20% annual return on investment. So the question is, if this is really infrastructure, if this is really as important to people as electricity, and I have certainly heard many people saying that, that you move into a new house and just like you expect to be able to turn on a light, you expect to be able to have your broadband connected. The other thing is that, I mean, this is, bandwidth should be a commodity, something that comes to your home and then you figure out what services you want to purchase with it. And most people don't have that option right now. I mean, in Minneapolis, I get a choice between the phone company and the cable company, and that's the case in most places. Municipal wireless is an opportunity to create that third pipe into the home. But the problem is, if you create that third pipe, but you make it a third privately owned pipe, and the city enters into a contract as an anchor tenant for a single network for 10 years, you've just committed to that company for 10 years without any of the kind of guarantees or leverage that would allow you to say, enter into new contract negotiations. For example, if the city owns the infrastructure, you can enter into a, you know, 2 or 3 year service level agreement for someone to manage the network.
There's a good case for that in airport authority contracts versus the contracts you're talking about, where when I've looked at, and this has happened actually because a lot of airports got early Wi-Fi networks or early combined Wi-Fi cellular networks in which one operator builds it out. And I've known in talking to them, even though the networks are entirely privately owned and operated, typically, or privately owned and operated, the airport authority has reserved an enormous amount of power to themselves based on performance targets, technology upgrades, just even fulfilling the contract by getting enough usage. And Seattle, for instance, had a multi-year contract with Wayport, which it had service in the very early days, in I think 2000. They switched to what was then AT&T Wireless, now Singular, soon to be AT&T Wireless again, to provide a combination of cellular nodes and Wi-Fi service. You know, and they were able to do that, sort of slipstream in a new contract. And some of these contracts for airports were signed for 2 or 3 or 5 years. But you know, I wonder where the bar is. You know, in the Minneapolis case, would you prefer, what do you want Minneapolis to own? Do you want them to hire private companies to build infrastructure that Minneapolis then owns and then could again hire private companies to operate under some terms, but the wire in the ground, the fiber in the ground, the nodes in the air, those are going to be the property of the city? Is that what you would prefer to see envisioned?
That's exactly what St. Louis Park has done. Mm. St. Louis Park is a suburb of Minneapolis. And what they did, they issued two documents. They issued a request for bids for the hardware, and they issued a request for proposals for network management and service provision.
Hmm.
They chose, St. Louis Park had already installed a pretty extensive fiber optic network. And so they were looking for someone to add wireless to that. And that is being handled by a company called First Mile Wireless, which is a local company here in Minnesota. And the city is paying for that under a, you know, normal bid letting kind of process, and so then the city will own that infrastructure. Parallel to that, they issued a request for proposals for someone to provide services. And interestingly enough, one of the proposals submitted was from the city of Chaska, which is about another 15 miles out west, where the city, of course, owns the wireless network, and until just recently they also managed it and were the service provider. And as of February, they have outsourced that, and that's now being handled by a private company.
Right, that's a hornet's nest we don't have to get into in this conversation.
No, we don't.
There'll be more about Chaska coming up.
Yeah, but so that's exactly what St. Louis Park has done. They own the infrastructure. They have a service agreement with a company called Unplug Cities that is managing the network for them and is the service provider, and will handle all the customer support and everything. They're actually going to handle the billing through the city's water and sewer billing system,
mm-hmm.
because that's already in place and that cuts down on some costs.
That's a
and
big
what
issue
that means.
That I hear that from a lot of companies. Bill presentment can cost an enormous amount per customer if you have to develop it from scratch. It costs many several dollars a customer, even for something of that scale.
Yeah, so the advantage there is that if Unplugged Cities performs poorly, and I'm not saying they will, but if they do perform poorly, that bid can be relet. You know, they can serve out the contract, or but it's a 2 to 3 year contract, which they haven't entered finalized the terms. That'll be in July. But the city has some options there. Now compare that to Minneapolis. And Minneapolis has said, we are going to use this wireless network for public safety data communications.
Mm-hmm.
That essentially means they are dependent on that network. There's, you know, this isn't like cable television where, and let's face it, cities have been, you know, Name me one city that has tossed out their cable franchisee. They all want to do it, but they've never done it. Why? Because it would leave their residents without cable television.
Well, and the irony, too, is Philadelphia fought for years to prevent a competitive cable television operator from entering the market, too.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, so even in a situation where their citizens would be denied cable television, the cities have been reticent to take any strong action against the cable franchisee. With the wireless, we're talking about a situation where the city itself is going to be dependent on the network for its own internal functioning needs. How does the city have any leverage in that situation? They're not going to cut off the network because they need it. And the only way to get an alternative network is to convince somebody else to build you a new one, which if you've got an existing network there, if you've entered into a contract, if somebody has put up all those costs and is an existing service provider, it's a pretty long shot that another competitor is going to be willing to come along and enter into that contract with you, because they may feel that they're at risk also of losing what they see as the their capital investment because the anchor tenant pulls out.
Well, this has been interesting too, because I think Minneapolis was the first place in which we heard an agreement that essentially established a de facto franchise without the same kinds of protections and hearings that go into establishing franchises. And I think Anaheim wound up, the contract they signed with Earthlink is a franchise contract. They decided to not charge a franchise fee in the end, but to collect tax through other means. But, you know, in Minneapolis, I remember reading the RFP and thinking, there's really nothing difference between this and signing up a cable company to offer cable service, except the word franchise isn't being used.
Well, and in the city's original documents, they used the word franchise all the time. They've stopped using it because they don't want to be painted into that corner. But if you look, when they first started talking about it, they referred to it as a franchise.
Right, and they're not. And there's some tricky things there too, because of the 1996 Telecom Act. I was just reading parts the other day about the utility pole issue. Is the city, whether it owns utility or not, or the utilities, whether they're city controlled or not, are not allowed to restrict reasonable access at reasonable non-discriminatory identical fees. So there's cities in which I'm hearing different stories about, I think this is happening in Michigan, where one utility is being reticent and they're allowed to have, they can put up some bars, but they may want a separate permit for every pole that's involved, where if you look at a proposal like Minneapolis's, Philadelphia, San Francisco, they're proposing streamlining access. So if you want to get 4,000 poles, you'll fill out one set of forms and sign one contract for all those poles.
Of course, in Minneapolis, they don't own most of the poles. So that's they're simply agreeing to help the winning bidder negotiate with the power company, but they don't even own the polls.
Well, you know, before we run out of time, we should talk a bit about St. Paul, too, because I think this has been an interesting contrast. I just started reading about this. I think St. Paul's been much more conservative and quiet about the direction they're proceeding, but it seems like they're a direct contrast. Their approach from the beginning is a direct contrast, and maybe in reaction to the feedback that's come out of the Minneapolis request for proposals.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say one thing quickly about Anaheim, which is that, I mean, I respect Anaheim. They didn't have any broad social goals, right? They didn't have any particular municipal service needs. They simply said wireless would be cool. And the entire Anaheim agreement with Earthlink is a single page.
Fascinating.
This is not a big complicated transaction. So what Anaheim did is very different from what Minneapolis did, which is that they just said, yeah, go ahead, do wireless, fine. Whereas Minneapolis, I mean, you know, or Philadelphia, it's, you know, four different legal agreements, each one of them being 50 pages, that kind of thing.
That's right. You've got a long analysis that I'll link to on your site of the Philadelphia contracts. I remember when it was came out that, well, they're going to have to sign a contract, the city council have to approve it, and the city council said, well, we can't approve this immediately because we've just plumped several hundred pages of documentation on our desks and you want us to vote tomorrow. And it took months for them to go through it, and then it came out it was not one contract, but five contracts, I believe, so far that are involved because of the different utilities and Wireless Philadelphia is an intermediary. So very complicated to get all the parties together at the table. But let me not distract from saying,
St. Paul, exactly. I mean, St. Paul saw what was happening in Minneapolis, and said, we're going to do this, but we want to do this in a much more deliberative and purposeful way. And one of the five counselors there who I have just the highest respect for is Lee Helgen, who said to me, you know, when we first started looking at this, we were inundated by vendors who just came to us and said, we can sell you this, we can do it all for you, and it'll be great. And he said, you know, I know that had we chosen to do that, we would have gotten some kind of citywide wireless network and access would have been around $20 and it would have been fine. And everything would have been okay and people would have been happy. But it was only by taking the time to learn more about it and to learn about the resources that the city of St. Paul has and the different ways that we could use it. It was only taking the time to understand all these things that I realized how much we would be giving up by doing it in that way. So St. Paul chose to, you know, take a technology inventory, map out all the city-owned fiber, figure out, you know, where the different networks interconnected in terms of the incumbents' networks, and do a needs assessment. They took the time to hold multiple community forums, both with just citizens, town hall style, anybody can show up, and with community leaders and small businesses and large businesses and all of the higher education institutions in St. Paul, and there are quite a few colleges. So they've done all that, and they've put it together in a substantial report that looks at everything St. Paul has mm-hmm. and considers the different technology paths they might choose and the different business models and ownership paths that they might choose. And they've laid it all out there. And now, with all of that information at their fingertips, the council members and assisted by the task force that they are forming can make some really informed decisions about where St. Paul should go.
And so there's a task force that's in formation right now that we were talking before we started the interview that that's the next step, right? Is this task force is going to be formed and then we'll go forward to figure out the recommendations for how to proceed on this.
The plan at this point is to have the task force start meeting in a couple of weeks and to meet and discuss and work with the existing information to write up some kind of request for information. Mm-hmm. That would be issued in the fall, and then work from the responses to the RFI and really, you know, think about what's out there, think about what will be best for St. Paul and get feedback in terms of what the community wants. And one of the things that amazed me was that I attended all of the community meetings, and over and over again, I heard people say, we want this, it's a basic utility, and we realize that we're kind of, you know, the technology elite, the people who have shown up for these meetings. But we are willing to pay more so that other people can get free or subsidized access. We think it's that important. We want other people's children to have access to the internet in the same way that our children do. And that strong community spirit is kind of been inherent in St. Paul for many years. But I think that there's just a very strong feeling at this time that this is something that everyone in the community needs in order for the city to be strong and to have a strong education system and to do the things that maximize your local resource base. Hey, which brings us back to the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
Well, so. It's fascinating that you're right there in the heart where you're going to have two separate procedures. Well, and let's point out too, I just had to do a quick internet search because Minneapolis picked its two finalists in October of 2005. It was Earthlink and US Internet, which is a local firm, and supposedly the next step was for them to set up pilot projects. I don't know if that went forward. It's always a good
not
stage.
Yet.
So it's possible by the time the task force in St. Paul is ready to issue an actual set of RFPs or final recommendations, Minneapolis might still not have a company picked either. So there's still maybe we should close on that. Is there potential for Minneapolis to say, hey, this process turned out to be really broken and we want to go back and think about it again based on what's going on elsewhere in the country? Or are they pretty committed and they're going to anoint someone and a contract will be signed?
I think it's funny because heels are pretty dug in the on the policy level in Minneapolis. I think that there is some possibility for a vendor revolt. The pilot was supposed to be up and running in mid-May, and then June, and then late June, and it looks like it might be going in mid-July. And my understanding is that the city is demanding even more services, and the vendors are saying, you know, can we just get the pilot up and see if it works?
Yeah.
So I think that there is the possibility for things in Minneapolis to go awry, but I don't think it will be out of a change in stubbornness on the policy level. I think that there are some legitimate vendor concerns.
Right. Well, I'll be checking back in with you as these both proposals progress, because it's fascinating that for, you know, a group that's a Institute for Local Self-Reliance, that you have a local situation that gives you a perfect chemistry lab in which to see what could be mixed and matched. And, you know, of course, you're going to have a great I told you so situation if Minneapolis turns out to not work out the way that they hope it does, but also you'll have the opportunity to provide advice there as well. In the same case, you don't have to. And I think we started this conversation by saying that your group, it's not about issuing reports, it's about providing practical information, about providing information that people can take action on. And it seems like it's needed locally for your two paired cities there more than anywhere else.
There's no question. And I just want to say that I don't want to have to say I told you so. I mean, I have to live here. I want wireless as bad as anybody else.
That's the fundamental thing, isn't it? Is that the local part is that you want to live in the community, get the benefit of it. Having a schadenfreude, it doesn't really help anybody in that situation.
Nope.
That's great. Well, thank you very much. I've been talking to Becca Vargo Daggett from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance about, some local politics, but also about the broader issue of municipal wireless and ownership. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Glenn.
You've been listening to podcast number 4, recorded June 27, 2006, an interview with Becca Vargo Daggett of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I welcome your feedback about these podcasts and suggestions for future podcasts. Audio is a different medium, and I'd like to talk to as many different people as possible to bring their voices directly to you. I mean, sometimes we run long, this interview is over 40 minutes, but I think the unadulterated and unedited form of these interviews makes it easier for you to know what people are actually saying as opposed to the distillation that's normally heard and that I normally provide. The next podcast will be with Nigel Ballard of Intel, a community wireless advocate of long standing who is now deeply involved with digital inclusion efforts and disaster relief efforts at Intel. We'll talk about that soon. These podcasts can be found archived online and at the iTunes Music Store. You can subscribe to them through a podcast reader or feeder like the iTunes Music Program by finding the podcast link in the left navigation bar at wifinetnews.com. This is Glenn Fleischman, the editor of Wi-Fi Networking News. Thanks for listening.